Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ron Rash, whose latest novel is The Cove. Earlier novels include Serena, The World Made Straight. There are 9 books of fiction in all. Burning Bright, a collection of short stories. There are 3 collections of poetry. There's a children's book. And Ron Rash has been called the Bard of Appalachia somewhere along the way. He teaches at Western Carolina University, professor of Appalachian Cultural Studies. Before we get into the book, I was realizing as I was reading about you that for people in most of the rest of the country, your area is kind of unknown. You list writers on one website who are Appalachian writers. I had not heard of any of them. It seems that even though a lot of regionalism is dead, this one area, which I guess encompasses North Carolina, South Carolina, what is it, Kentucky?
Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, Southwest Virginia.
That's still pretty much a giant blank spot on the map in the rest of America. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an area that is more rural, and it tends to, traditionally, has been perhaps more isolated than much of the country. And I think sometimes people, sometimes because of popular culture, have a kind of view that it's primitive, that the people are just kind of hidden away. You know, one of my hopes is that I give a little more complex vision of the region.
You talk a lot about, in the interviews I've seen, about the importance of location, mm-hmm. the importance of place in your work, and maybe in general. At one point, I know you quote Eudora Welty as saying, one place helps us understand other places better. But you also say in another interview, landscape is destiny, which means that for you, I guess, for a book like The Cove, the landscape is almost another character.
I hope it is. I hope the reader feels that way, and particularly in The Cove, that perhaps the major character. One thing I'm very fascinated with is how the landscape a person lives in affects his or her psychology, her perception of reality. I tell my students that Gatsby, could only have been born in the Midwest, that kind of expansive vision. And I think people who live in mountains, not just in Appalachia, but in other mountainous regions around the world, are in some ways shaped by that landscape.
How do you mean that? I mean, I was thinking as I was driving over here, looking at, Berkeley, and I grew up in New York City. When you say we're shaped by our landscape, what exactly does that mean?
My perception of it is, and from my own experience and my family's experience, because my family's been in the Appalachians for a couple of centuries, actually, is that that landscape, at least what I've seen within my own family and generations of my family, very often is so daunting that the person who lives in that landscape is constantly reminded of his or her insignificance. The mountains rise up. And today, people build houses on, I understand, on cliff tops, ridge tops. But traditionally, those houses would have been in very low-lying areas because of water sources. And because of that, they would be places where very little light would get in. Now, in a more positive way, I think what I've sensed with mountain cultures, not, and once again, not just in Appalachia, but I've had people from other parts of the world agree with me on this about mountain people, is that there's also a sense of being protected, nurtured, almost like a womb-like presence. So I think it can work, both positively and negatively.
I interviewed Tony Hurwitz in his mm-hmm. book about John Brown when he's talking about Harper's Ferry mm-hmm. and the high cliffs. That's part of the same region as the Cove, so it produces all kinds of strange religious and, I guess, political movements mm-hmm. as well. And do you think that's because of landscape, too?
I suspect. I mean, I think there's an adage, I can't remember where it came from, that the idea that the prophets come from the mountains very often, or they have to go to the mountains in many cultures to get that kind of illumination. So, I don't want to make too much of it, but I do find it interesting.
Well, the cove itself, when I think of a cove, I think of a small area of water, right off of a lake or an ocean. But this is kind of different, this cove. It's just, I don't even know if there's water there. It's just kind of overhung with cliffs and very, very dark all the time. Is that pretty much it?
Right. Some people might call it a ravine. Some people might call it a gorge. But it's usually an area between high mountains where it goes very deep into an area. It's usually very dark or more dark than the surrounding area and tends to be inhospitable.
So when people try to farm there, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be really tough.
It's a tough environment, and I think, once again, that certainly affects the way people perceive reality. I mean, it is not a place. I mean, very often people think of the South as being mansions and plantations, but that's not the Appalachian South. The Appalachian South is almost exclusively, or was exclusively, small farms, very often on ridges, and pretty tough life, pretty tough livelihood.
Ron Rash, this book, as with all of your books, begins with an image. You had an image in your head, in this case, a woman peering through the branches of a bush and seeing a bedraggled man playing a silver flute. Did that just pop up to you?
It did. As you say, every novel I've written has begun with a single image, and the more I write, the more mysterious the process becomes. Where these images come from, I don't know. In a way, I really don't want to know. I'm just happy when they occur. I get an image I cannot seem to get out of my head, and eventually, it's almost like running a fever. I know, I know the symptoms. I think writers have to have certain lies that enable them to go on. And one thing I always believe when I start a novel, starting it with an image, I never have a sense. I don't outline, I don't plot, I don't even know where it's going. But what I do believe, or I make myself believe, is that if the image is strong enough, that the novel is already there. It's a matter of finding it. In some ways, it's a little bit like when Michelangelo would say that the completed statue was always inside the stone, the block of marble. And I make myself believe that the novel's out there.
So when you get these images, I mean, did that image come after you finished Serena? Did it come earlier on and you just put it in the back of your mind, or what happened?
It came after Serena. Yeah, I'd finished up Serena. I was working on some short stories. I'd been doing a good bit of research about German internment camps in North Carolina and also what happened with the Vaterland. Yeah, it was almost as if I was waiting for something to allow me to enter into the story that I'd been researching.
So you knew at that point that your book would probably take place in the waning days of World War One, that it would involve a German internment camp, which we'll go into in a moment, and this ship, the Vaterland. You kind of knew that was there, but you didn't know how or what, and then suddenly comes the image.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I didn't know for sure that I would be able to get a novel out of it. I just thought, well, this is a very interesting story, and perhaps something could come out of it. It was only when I got the image that I started writing it.
So how did you find out about these German internment camps during World War One?
Well, it's an amazing story, and as I've been going around the country on book tour, it's really interesting how few people even realize that there were German internment camps. I mean, we all are very aware of the Japanese internment camps during World War II, but these were German internment camps. These were German citizens. They were not soldiers. I was actually doing some research on Western North Carolina. I'd heard about the camp, but I'd really not gone into – I'd always assumed it was a prisoner of war camp. And once I started doing research, I suddenly realized, no, this was an internment camp. And I found that fascinating because it was only about 60 or 70 miles from where I live.
Really? And it was in a hotel or something?
Well, actually, some of the officers from a ship that we'll be talking about, I suspect, were there, but many of the inmates – they were high barbed wire and less elegant. But, a hotel that actually held some of the more prestigious internees.
Which is why our internee is there and
yes.
Mike can actually escape.
Right,
because there
right.
isn't that much barbed wire around a hotel.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing I think was pretty obvious was if you're a German citizen, where do you escape to when you're in the middle of a very rural Appalachian landscape?
How did you find out that there was this ship that sat in the harbor in New York for 3 years, this luxury liner called the Vaterland, which couldn't go back because they were afraid they'd be sunk by torpedoes?
I actually found a book about the it was actually called the Hot Springs Camp because that was the name of the community where the camp was in Western North Carolina. I started reading kind of incidentally that some of these prisoners had come from a ship, actually the largest ship in the world, the most luxurious ship in the world at that time, that had been, as you say, marooned in New York City in the harbor or New York Harbor for 3 years, which I was in New York doing book tour 2 weeks ago, and no one in the audience even knew about this, which I found, you know, it's amazing that this piece of history is not even well known seemingly in New York City.
For 3 years, the people on the ship, which meant the musicians, all the stewards, everybody else, all of the help, everybody who was on the ship, was free to roam around. They had nothing to do. And I guess they just stayed on the ship, went ashore, and went to museums and hung out in the park and got gigs playing. The musicians got gigs playing in various venues.
When I was doing research, I read about them swimming in the Hudson River in the summer and, you know, ice skating in the park wintertime and still getting paid. They were still getting paid. The United States was still neutral, so the money was able to get from Hamburg to the crew. So they were having a pretty good life, much luckier than they would have been if they'd been in Europe and young men.
In which case, they'd have become cannon fodder.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ron Rash, you see this woman peering through the bushes. Okay, at that point, you're pretty sure that the flutist is going to be someone from the Vaterland, or don't you even know that?
I think I do, because obviously the fact that he's playing a flute, a silver flute, in the middle of, you know, as I say, this very isolated region. So, yeah, I knew then, and that was the link that I needed.
Gradually, I understand what you do is you sit down and you just write, and you try to turn off every single thing that will stop you from writing, you know, every single critical brain, just to let all this junk come out that you can then mold. Is that pretty much it?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And it's something a lot of people don't want to be around me when I'm doing it, because I usually tend to write about 10 or 12 hours trying to, you know, for about, sometimes it's up to about a month before I just completely collapse. For me, the part I hate most about writing novels is first draft. I just want to get something down. And it is like a potter. I mean, I just want a big, ugly hunk of clay to throw down and play with.
During that period, how big is that final first manuscript, which will wind up being something completely different in the final form?
Right. Yeah, very often it's short. I mean, I think probably the first draft I had of this novel was maybe around 80 pages.
How close was that to what we're reading here in terms of story?
Probably 10% remained from that opening.
Were the characters somewhat formed? Was Laurel, the woman, was she formed at that point?
She was. What I didn't realize was I thought the story might be more about the German escapee, but as I got into the novel, I realized the story was really more hers than his. That does shift at the very end. But I had another character that was a pretty significant character I had to get rid of. He just wasn't working, and I actually did a lot of research on jazz, or the nascent jazz movement that had kind of come from New Orleans, Chicago, and was just starting in New York. I thought I might have Walter playing, being a little, you know, early Herbie Mann, playing flute with some jazz musicians, or they wouldn't have called themselves jazz musicians then. That didn't work either, so I had to just discard all that research, which is always, that's tough. It was probably about 50 pages of writing and probably 15 books of research, and that's almost like tearing out organs from your body, but it has to be done sometimes.
And so eventually what you thought might have been kind of a book, an epical book like Serena, kind of shrinks into more of a fast-paced story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, much more so. A smaller, lighter, not lighter, but necessarily, but a more compressed book, not the kind of big book that Serena is. Yeah.
There's another character named Chauncey, kind of the villain of the piece. Was he always there?
Not really, though. I pretty early on, I sensed that one thing I wanted this novel to do, and I want all my novels to do this, even though a novel set in the past, I think very often, as Emily Dickinson says, tell the truth, but tell it slant. I think writing about the past is always an interesting way to talk about the present. And I felt Chauncey exemplified an aspect of, you know, what happened actually in World War I, because there were some Germans lynched in the United States, but also very similar to what's happening today with the idea of who is a patriot and who isn't.
He's the son of the wealthy man in town. He's the one who is the recruiter, but he never goes off to war, and when he sees people coming back, damaged, he doesn't necessarily see that they're patriots.
No. I mean, particularly maybe because I come from the Appalachian region where I see today so many of our young people are the ones who end up doing the fighting over there. But it doesn't seem to be the people sending them over there. It's not their children. I personally believe that we would not still be, we would not nearly have been in that both of these wars as long except that we don't have a draft. I continue to be amazed, having just missed the Vietnam era, but, being about 14 or 15, remembering all the campus demonstrations, and yet you hardly hear a murmur from colleges now because none of the young people at the colleges are affected. As I say, the region where I'm from, we have an inordinate number of our young people in it and being, maimed and killed. I find it distressing just that, it just seems to be such a, today even a hidden story, what's happening.
In Appalachia, is there any kind of anti-war movement that has arisen from this?
Not really. I think it is a conservative area, and unfortunately, it very often is the only way out for a number of our young people. To go to college, to serve, and then be able to get a GI Bill or something the equivalent. But in many ways, our region's like the rest of the country. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of protests. I mean, maybe it's changing. I think there's a sense that it's changing somewhat, but. I just think it's sad for these young people coming back.
The sense I get, maybe I'm wrong, is that World War I Appalachia is closer in terms of how people live to today than, say, World War I New York was. Or is that just simply my misapprehension because I'm living in California?
This is always a tricky area because, on one hand, as somebody from the region, I don't want to encourage the stereotypes that vary of the region. But at the same time, it is a region that has, I would argue, always and continues to have more taken from it than given to it by our country, whether it's coal or timber or young people to go fight wars. And, part of that is the fact that it's rural and that it has been more isolated. Not all sections, certainly, but certainly, a good bit of poverty.
You've said in talking about writing that the key moment in a good short story is when we learn about the world in a way that we had not imagined before. In looking at The Cove, what do you think is that point? Is it when we find out who Walter is?
Perhaps, but also perhaps maybe I would like to think that particularly Laurel, who is someone who's grown up in this environment that has been so tremendously tough on her. That we start to realize that she has possibilities that we might not have assumed, certainly an intelligence, a love of learning. But to me, maybe the most impressive thing is her ability to imagine, to use her imagination to transcend this world, particularly as she's learning about this ship and she's imagining it in her mind.
And that ship that she's imagining, I guess for you, that comes right out of looking at pictures of the ship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. I had to go all the way I didn't have to go there, but I ordered a book that was very, very limited edition about the Vaterland. And I actually had to get it from New Zealand. That was the only place where a rare book dealer in New Zealand had it. But, it was an amazing ship. The photographs are just stunning.
When you're doing research, I think World War I in the past few years has almost come back in vogue. I suspect it's because, much like the Iraq War, it never made any sense. I mean, that's my feel.
Yeah. Oh, I would agree, and we're coming up, almost 100 years now since it began, so I think that certainly makes it interesting to us. But, it's a war that, actually, as I was going back and working on the book, I reread the Iliad because it just kind of struck me that, it's just that kind of war where, one side's winning and then the other, and it's just confusion, and no one seems to understand very often what's all the fighting about. So it's a very, I would agree with that.
And it went on for like 5 years in Europe, and so many were killed. And even though I've done reading on it, including, Guns of August, mm-hmm. books like that, I still haven't got a bead on what happened, why it happened. And, of course, when it ended, the armistice was such that just a mere 13 years later, 14 years later, back in the war.
Yeah, I've read, not an extensive amount, but I've read enough to just to realize that it must have been, just horrific. And to imagine, particularly Europe, what it must have been like after that to just see that and then realize, we're just setting up the next one. I think there's an anecdote. I think it was one of the French generals was buried, allegedly standing up facing the German border because he said, it's going to happen again. This was a World War I general.
Ron Rash, you grew up Southern Baptist. For you, I guess, being a Southern Baptist growing up in that, and you've said you were immersed in it, how do you as a writer, how does that, you think, come out in books like Sereno or The Cove?
Very often, maybe a more tragic view of mankind, a belief in man's fallibility, certainly, which I would argue all you have to do is pretty much look at the 20th century to find that to be true. But also something that was actually, and Flannery O'Connor's talked about this, I think it was a great gift, was actually growing up reading the King James Version of the Bible, which is just one of the most beautifully written books in the English language. And it was something I didn't, obviously I wasn't aware of this at the time, but that deep immersion in that book, I think, is has been a great gift to me as a writer. Just as I say, knowing that language, so I hope that the reader senses that some of the poetry I try to get into my novels perhaps began with those readings from King James.
Speaking about poetry, you're a poet and a novelist. You've said that when you're writing one, you can't do the other. Is that because one needs to be spare and the other needs to be metaphoric, or what?
I'm not sure. I think it maybe more of it comes down, for me at least, in seeing poetry in lines. One thing I'm very interested in my poetry, and partly because of my interest in Welsh poetry, is sound play within the line. And I love that. And so I think when I'm working on poetry, I tend to look at what's happening with vowel and consonant sounds within a line. And I do care about those things in my fiction, certainly. My last read-through of a novel, what I'm doing is just hearing sounds, how consonants and vowels play off each other within a sentence or within a paragraph.
Something like even like The Cove, the reading of it would have to be slower in order to be able to pick up the sound levels of the novel then.
Well, I do believe that very often people catch it up or hear it even maybe on a kind of subconscious level. When they're reading the prose, it seems to flow. There's a rhythm to it and there's an ease to it that it doesn't feel clunky. So I would hope that would be something at least I'm trying to do.
The thing about poetry, and I've read a couple of prose pieces by, say, Mark Doty, mm-hmm. and his prose resembles his poetry. Mm-hmm. To me, The Cove is more likely going to resemble American spare fiction writing rather than poetry. It comes at a completely different place.
I want it to be easy to read, yes, and I want it to flow very easily, but I hope that when the reader will at times hear it, as I say, or just see the language used in a way that's interesting, an image sometimes, or using a word perhaps in an unusual way.
The landscape, of course, is such a major part of The Cove, mm-hmm. and that has to come through poetry, I think.
Yeah, you're trying to make that memorable language.
Ron Rash, in 1998, you came out with a poetry collection called Eureka Mill. It talks about life in the mills of the area, which is declining, and I think your father was involved with the mills before he became a professor, correct?
Right.
And it's been called storytelling in poetry, which means that there's a story involved as well, which brings it more in the realm of novel.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason. I consider myself a narrative poet, primarily, more than lyric. Yeah, I think that makes the transition to fiction and back a little bit easier, the fact that it is narrative poetry.
Well, your first novel came out just a couple of years after that. After writing Eureka Mill, did you finally say, well, if I can do a long narrative piece in poetry, I can try it in prose?
I think that helped, yeah, because I wanted Eureka Mill to feel, at least in some ways, like a you know, as if reading, you know, some of the pleasure of reading a novel, you know, a sense of entering a world and being there for a while. And I just didn't know enough, or finally got to the point where I felt like I could had enough to write, you know, lived enough. I think a lot of times, not always, but very often novelists tend to be a little slower as opposed to poets in their development.
Once you began writing, of course, you've written several novels since then. I'd like to ask you about a couple of those novels, Ron Rash. The World Made Straight is the story of the Sheldon Laurel Massacre in bloody Madison County in 1863. I've never heard of that. What was it?
Well, it's actually a story that was reported in the New York Times. I actually went back and did research. I think people have a somewhat of a sense of this. Maybe they don't, but the Appalachian South had very strong Unionist sympathies during the Civil War. That's true even in my own family. I had more family fighting for the Union than the Confederacy. You know, largely because, as I say, you know, the plantations that you would have in other parts of the South were not in the, you know, the high mountains, certainly. But the Shelton Laurel Massacre was an event where the little area of Shelton Laurel, once again, not far from where I teach now and where my family's actually lived in that county, they were Union sympathizers, and most of the men had gone off to Tennessee to fight for the Union Army. They were called Lincolnites. But a Confederate troop came through and rounded up 14 men and boys. Most of them were just older men, grandfathers, but there was a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old boy, and they were allegedly taking them across the mountain into Tennessee to a camp, a prisoner of war camp, even though they were civilians. But they actually took them about a couple of miles outside of Shelton Laurel and ended up just shooting them down, killing them all, including the 12-year-old boy and the 14-year-old boy. Really haunting, and I've actually been to the site. They were all buried in a single grave, and I don't want to get too mystical here, but I think there are certain places that feel more real than you are when you're in there. I've had a friend who said that, you know, felt that way at Normandy Beach. I mean, and obviously you're bringing a lot of that with you, but that place felt that way. I mean, you feel like something happened here.
Serena is a book that deals with environmental issues. You wrote and talked about in writing the book that it felt more about present time than 1929 to 30. It's about a woman who is kind of an Ayn Rand-type capitalist who is busy despoiling Appalachia. What was the original image of that?
It was an image of a woman on horseback. I was seeing it in silhouette. There was a little bit of ground fog. She was on a ridge crest, ground fog beneath her. The sun was coming up behind her. She has blonde hair, and it hit her hair, and it's almost like as if she were between earth and sky, and almost a crown around her head. So that, and I knew somebody was looking at her with a mixture of awe and fear.
And had you been doing research on environmentalism and what was happening, the despoiling of the environment at the time?
I was very concerned. This was, you know, during, I guess, about, this started about 8 or 9 years ago, where there was a real effort to open up national forests for timbering. I mean, there still is, you know, and it was really distressing to me, particularly because I live about 15 miles from the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and I knew how hard won that park was. I mean, the fact that that park was created during the Depression is just amazing, and to think that we might lose that. And so, once again, I'd done a lot of research. I knew about the park. And then when that image came to me, I realized, okay, here's how I, once again, how I'll enter this story about, because a lot of people don't realize this, but the Smoky Mountains were completely, almost completely harvested. There are just a few virgin trees in the Smoky Mountains.
Well, there's also a blight, a chestnut tree blight. Mm-hmm. So there, the entire region was filled with chestnut trees, and they're gone now, right?
Yeah. And that's one of the saddest things. Actually, my grandmother, who was a school teacher, she actually rode horseback in the mountains of North Carolina. She kept journals, and she has this amazing journal entry, heartbreaking, where she talks about seeing the chestnut trees die. You know, this was like in the 1930s.
So by the time you were growing up, the chestnut trees were mostly gone?
Oh, yeah. They were, and they were such a great food source for, you know, for animals and for people.
In working on a book like Serena, which took so much out of you, Was there a sense that for a book like The Cove you wanted it to be shorter, or did that just come out of the writing?
I think I probably wanted a book that was going to be shorter and not quite as expansive, or not nearly as expansive as Serena. That Serena felt like, for me, you know, my big book. I've written other novels, and I feel good about those novels, but Serena, I think, was a novel that, for whatever reason, was the one that really kind of opened up in a way none of my other novels have.
Now that you've finished this, you going back to short stories, or...
I am, and with great relief. You know, one thing I did, I started The Cove very close, right after, you know, very close to when I'd finished Serena, and I could really feel it. I felt like I was running a marathon every day, having finished it, and I feel good about the book, but I am really relieved to be going back to short stories, and I love short stories. I love the form. And it's been nice to go back to that.
What is it about the short story that attracts you?
I think it's the hardest to do well. You know, poetry, novels, and short stories, having written all three. And I think what strikes me about a really good short story by someone such as Chekhov or James Joyce or Flannery O'Connor, is that they give you the satisfaction in a sense of a novel. Not the depth, obviously, but the sense of a completed narrative. The satisfaction of that we get in a novel, yet at the same time, the concision that we love about poetry. It seems to me that the best short stories are a merger of those two things.
Well, I've noticed two kinds of short stories. Some where there's completion, it's a narrative leading to something, and some just seem to stop. What kind are you drawn to and why?
I think I do both. I think sometimes the story makes the decision on whether it should be one of those that's more open-ended or one that has that traditional narrative. I think what the best stories and the stories I would hope that I try to write are ones in which, and I think writers such as Alice Munro and William Trevor do this amazingly, a story where the writer takes a character and maybe just shows a small moment in his or her life. Yet at the same time, the reader feels as if that whole life, what that life has been and what that life will be, has been revealed. I think that can happen in a story that in some ways perhaps is open-ended, but also one that once again has that, as we say, that traditional arc.
Well, now you've been writing a while. Has there been any interest from Hollywood in your books?
Well, Serena's being filmed right now.
Oh, really?
In Czech Republic. I'm very happy with the people involved. Suzanne Beer, the Danish director, who did In a Better World, is directing. And Jennifer Lawrence is playing Serena. I think she'll do a great job because she grew up in Kentucky and knows horses. And Serena spends a lot of time on horseback. And I think she's a fine actress. So, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they interpret the book.
Have you had interest in writing plays?
It's interesting. I actually had somebody ask me that recently. I love dialogue. I love writing dialogue. I've never done a play, but I think that might be something I'll try eventually. I love plays. I love to see how they work, you know, so much of it, as I say, with the use of dialogue to convey so much, but haven't done it yet, but maybe.
Ron Resch, what are you working on now?
I'm finishing up a book of short stories. Actually, it'll be out next March, and as we speak, I'm doing my last edits before I turn it in to be copy edited, so I'm still working.
Ron Resch, Appalachia was known traditionally for being kind of politically progressive. Democrats owned West Virginia for a long time, and slowly it's become more and more right-wing, and we can't necessarily blame it on the Baptists because they were Baptists all along.
Yeah.
What is it that's doing that now, and those of us in more urban areas are quite worried about some of the people who have been supported in places like that, like Rick Santorum. Is there any way to turn that around?
I see some hope. I mean, Obama carried North Carolina, you know, which surprised a lot of people. I don't know. I'm always a little leery of even talking about that, just because I think I just want to try to be fair to my region as well. I do think that we live in a society at large where it seems that the kind of deep thinking that people need to in a democracy is being subverted. I think part of that is just technology, the fact that we create, making our brains more, you know, more willing just to take small sound bites. I see it as a more general problem of just the kind of deep immersion into understanding that, that a healthy democracy needs. One thing that I found that does disturb me is, and this particularly because it very often comes from people that allegedly are more liberal, is a kind of just the most kind of abusive stereotypes that they would not use with any other group. And, you know, I mean, talking about stupid hillbillies and toothless hillbillies. And yet, to me, if you hear someone, as I recently heard, you know, a national commentator say, you know, it's Toothless Tuesday, you know, in the South. I mean, how would you expect people to react to that? And to me, that what made that even more disturbing is, what is he really mocking? He's mocking the fact that these people are poor and cannot afford dental care.
One of the issues in America is that there's so many other issues that people tend to forget that maybe underneath it, it's about class.
I think class is still a problem here. And I think if you are someone who is liberal and left-leaning, probably the worst thing you can do is to demonize you, because you're doing the very thing that you're accusing the right of doing. I'm always leery of people on the far, you know, not I don't even want to use the terms left or right, but, right. But people who are uncomfortable in the gray but only want the black and white scare me, because they're both wanting the same thing, to control you, control the way you think. I think complexity in thought is important. And I think that's one thing good literature gives us.
Good literature will raise the questions, not necessarily give you the answers.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think the best literature usually is in the gray areas, yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Ron Rash, whose latest novel is The Cove. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.